In my trouble, you will answer me with your mighty hand against my enemies. Fill your purpose that you have for me. You reign forever, you won't abandon me.
Okay, we're in 2 Samuel chapter 23. We finished the book tonight. Woohoo! Is that a woohoo? That's a woohoo. I think that's a good woohoo. Second Samuel, we'll try to pull off two chapters tonight. We'll see how I go. We've seen David become king of Israel. That's all happened in this book. We've seen him commit this terrible sin that he is quite infamous for, his adultery with Bathsheba, and then trying to cover it up by murdering her husband, Uriah the Hittite. We've seen the fallout of David's sin, and the biggest was the rebellion of his son Absalom as he tore the nation apart and brought more than half of the people after him. And a civil war breaks out. David heads for the hills and leaves Jerusalem. And in the end, David's men are victorious, and Absalom, his son, is dead. David reestablishes himself as king, and we're now coming into the last couple chapters. By next week, when we start 1 Kings, we'll see the transition between the government transition between David to Solomon. We'll be hitting that next week. But this is kind of the end of David's reign in this week. Verse 1 of chapter 23. Now, these are the last words of David. Thus says David, the son of Jesse. Thus says the man raised up on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel. Last words of David. You know, we usually look at a person's final words as being kind of important. Kind of, you know, sometimes. It kind of tells you a lot about who a person is and what they're like. His last words were not, "He who dies with the most toys wins." That's not, I don't think that was on his, it might have been on I don't think it was on his chariot bumper sticker. I don't know. I found an interesting page on Wikipedia. Famous last words. Here's one. I am in the land of the dying, and I am soon going to the land of the living. I like that one. Do you like that one? That was John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace, the preacher in England, ex-slave trading captain. How about this one? Let's see if you can guess who this one is. How were the receipts today at Madison Square Garden? P.T. Barnum. This girl's sharp. I'm not going to ask you anymore. You're going to give away all my jokes, aren't you? Or this one. How about this one? I should never have switched from scotch to martinis. You know this one too? It's Humphrey Bogart. There we go. How about this one? I really like this one. I like this one. I just wish I had time for one more bowl of chili. It's Kit Carson, frontiersman, explorer. Lewis B. Meyer said, "It wasn't worth it." That's kind of sad. Here's one. Solely by the merits of Jesus Christ, our Savior. World-renowned astronomer Johannes Kepler said that. Believer. And I like this one. The best of all is God is with us. John Wesley, as he died. Interesting step. I don't know if I'll have something profound to say when I die or not. But it kind of tells you a little bit about the person, doesn't it? You know, some of it doesn't. You know, it's not a whole thing. But these are David's last words. Here it is, verse 2. The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me, he who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear, shining rain. I like that. I don't know that this is specifically going to be aimed at Solomon, but it's a king's dying words saying, hey, you better figure this out. If you rule over men, you have two ways to go. The godly ruler ruling, who must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And so there's a little bit of a lesson here about godly leaders. He puts in two qualities, justice and the fear of God. That's what a good ruler is all about. Justice is about doing the right things. The fear of God, having a healthy respect for God. I've been going on walks in the morning, and he says, he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises. I took this picture today, not thinking about this. There's a hill that would go up, it's up on Miramar, and as the hill goes up, the last couple mornings I've been there, just as the sun is like just peeking out over this hill, it's just this, the projector doesn't quite get it. The screen, you guys up in the front row, so you can see on the screen, it's a little bit cooler on the screen, but just, oh my gosh, it's been an awesome thing, especially going up this little rise of a hill. The light is like blinding, and it's like you're walking into heaven. It's kind of like you're walking into the presence of God. It's just like I'm just a touchy-feely guy sometimes, you know, and it just the light as it's just like blasting in your face. He says, the God of Israel spoke to me. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. He shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds. There's something awesome about that, something good, something right about that. Like the tender grass springing out of the earth by clear shining after rain. Like a watered garden. We walk by, there's some houses that we walk by sometimes. And there's this one house where they do run the sprinklers on one patch of their grass. And the rest of the house, I guess because of their water bill or whatever, but all around the corner of the house, on the side of the hill, even the other part of their front lawn, they let it go, and it's all brown, and they got this one spot that's green. But that's what a godly ruler will do. Someone who rules with justice, and someone who rules in the fear of God. You don't have to be the president for this to apply to you. If you have some aspect somewhere in your life where you have authority, where you work with people, it might just be with your kids. I mean, that's an awesome, awesome thing. But this is what godly leaders are all about. Have fear of God, knowing that there's somebody bigger than you. We read a couple days ago in our reading through the Bible in Colossians, masters, give your bondservants what is just and fair, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. That's the fear of God. Knowing there's somebody bigger. That's kind of a big problem that some of us run into when we think that we're at the top of the food chain. You're not. You're not at the top of the food chain. There's somebody bigger. And you have a choice. What kind of a leader are you going to be? Verse 5, although my house is not so with God, yet he has made me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For this is all my salvation and all my desire. Will he not make it increase? But, here's the contrast, but the sons of rebellion shall be as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in their place. The sons of rebellion. David knew what it was like to have people who rebelled, whether it was his son Absalom or later there was that other guy, Sheba, that Sheba fellow. You know, you have a choice as to what kind of authority you will wield in your life. You might be the low guy in the totem pole at work, but there is places where you exercise authority. If nothing more, you're over your own life. And so are you going to be someone who's thorny, prickly, who people got to touch with a spear to hold off and stuff like this? Or are you going to be a person who's like the rising of the morning sun? Or that was cool. I was grinning at you guys. Did Dan pick the songs for tonight? You know, as morning dawns and evening, that last song we did, I love it when a plan comes together. I love it when God puts all this stuff together. You can be a person who refreshes others by doing what's right, or you can be a pain in their neck. And that's our choice. That's his dying words. What kind of a leader are you going to be? Verse 8, David's mighty men. David's got kind of like this all-star group of guys. It's like his most awesome guys of all time. And as we go through this, I'm not going to pick out every single thing. But I'll pick out about three or four things, characteristics of David's mighty men. And to get us kind of in the mood of mighty men, I hope this sounds up. You've seen this commercial.
There are a few who move toward the sounds of chaos, ready to respond at a moment's notice. Time comes, they are the first to move toward the sounds of tyranny, injustice, and despair. They are forged in the crucible of training. They are the few, the proud, the Marines.
I love it. I love these commercials. They're just like awesome, you know. And knowing a few Marines, a couple that I respect very well. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff, you know. That's the way we ought to be, though, as believers. That's the way David's mighty men were. Which way would you run? Well, I'll tell you what. The guys you're going to read about here are guys who run into the battle. They're the ones who stand their ground. They're going to be the ones who defend those that they're standing up for. So verse 8, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Josheb-Bashabeth, the Tachmonite, chief among the captains. He was called Adino the Eznite. We'll talk about that in a minute. Because he had killed 800 men at one time. I think there's a hoorah thing followed in there in the text, I believe, is in there. These are the mighty men. The Hebrew word is gibor, the mighty men. And it means a strong man, a brave man, a mighty man, the mighty men. And that's what this group is called throughout the stories, David and his mighty men. It's kind of like Robin Hood and his merry men. Well, David had mighty men. I'll put David up against Robin Hood's men any day, especially when you read about these guys. Mighty men. Men who do big things. And ladies, when I'm saying men, you know I'm talking generically here, okay? So don't get offended that I'm leaving you out, okay? Big things. These are guys who did big things. These were ordinary men, you're going to see in a minute, who did extraordinary things. We believe that most of these men start with David kind of back a few years. We read about them in 1 Samuel chapter 22. This is while David is running for his life. This is when he's that man on the run. This is when Saul is out after David, when Saul has got his whole army trained on finding David. Verse 1 of 1 Samuel 22, David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him, And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented gathered to him, so he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. We think that's where this group comes from. They hearken back to these days of the cave of Adullam. They are called losers. Do you see that? Everyone who's in debt, distress, debt, and discontented. This is not a happy crowd. They're all the losers. And this is the group that gathers around David. God uses ordinary people who struggle, and God can do great things through ordinary people. This one fellow whose full given name is Josheb Bashabeth, the Tachmonite, but he's called Adino the Esnite. Adino means ornament. Esnite means spear. So his ornament is his spear. This is how the guy, this was his thing. Some people wear a fine looking hat when they walk into the room. This fellow's ornament was his spear. He let his spear do the talking. That was his ornament. This was this guy. If I read this correct, and I've checked all the translation, it's been a while since I've done Hebrew, so I just look at the translations, forgive me. But it looks like it says in one battle he kills 800 men with his spear. I do have some film of the event. I want to let you know this.
Okay, yourself.
Now that's not a, it's that guy, the guy with the dark hair. Watch how he uses this. It's just, this is, boy, it's dark with this projector. It's much better up there. He even fights without the spear. How about this? Isn't this amazing? Now, this is the PG version. We're not showing the actual deaths of these men. Oh, okay. There we go. There you go. Are we all in the battle moods here? Ready? All ready to fight and be bad and not with each other. So this is one of David's mighty men, 800 guys with his spear. He's known as the guy. The thing that makes him look good, he's got the spear with him. He's just like, stand back and watch, you know, just let the guy go. Let him through. Verse 9, after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite. Now, don't you tease him about his father's name, son of Dodo. Don't you dare do that when you get to heaven, because this is one of the mighty men. You don't mess with these guys. And by the way, Dodo, I found out, is actually a nickname for anybody named David, and it means beloved. And so I guess we could start calling you Dodo. What do you think? But it's meant to be a term of, you know, buddy, my pal, you know, kind of a thing. So this is not a silly thing like we think of Dodo. Eleazar, his name means God is my help. He was one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for battle, and the men of Israel had retreated. He arose and attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder. They didn't have to do anything else. He killed them all. It says his hand stuck to the sword. Apparently, this was not an uncommon thing in ancient days with sword fighting, is that you hold on to the thing for so long, your muscles, you freeze, and they have to pour warm water over your hand to loosen up the thing so you could let go of the thing. But this is what happened here with Eleazar. It says, verse 11, and after him was Shammah, the son of Agi the Hararite. the Philistines had gathered together. Here's his story. The Philistines had gathered together into a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils, beans. So the people fled from the Philistines, but he stationed himself in the middle of the field, defended it, and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought about a great victory. Now I want to throw these two together, Eliezer and Shammah, with Joshabeth, Bashabeth. His thing, the lesson was big things. Mighty men can do big things. With these two, I want to say they're a lesson of perseverance. One guy held on to his sword. He's not letting go till this battle's over. He held on to his sword. The other guy stationed himself on the battleground, and nothing's going to move him. He's digging in his feet, and he's not moving. That's perseverance, friends. That is a quality of a mighty man. Is you don't quit. You stay. You stick it out. You stay at it. Maybe you get knocked over, you get back up. And you stay at it. Some people might look at perseverance as stubbornness. They might say, oh, you're just a stubborn person. But you know what? Stubbornness used for the right things becomes perseverance. I'm going to be stubborn about doing the right thing. I'm standing my ground. You're not moving me out of here. I'm not letting go of this sword. The book of Hebrews was written to Jewish believers who were going through difficult stuff, being persecuted for their faith. They were being persuaded to try, they should let go of this Jesus stuff. But the whole book is wrapped around the idea that these Jewish believers need to hang on and persevere. The writer says in chapter 12, therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. How can you be a mighty man, a mighty woman? Endurance is one of those things. It's people might call you stubborn about your Christianity or about your walk, but that's how you get past being just a little fliff, you know, just a little nothing, into something substantial, something strong, is by endurance. And sometimes all that means is I'm just not going to quit. I may have to get up a couple times. I may get knocked over, but I'm just not going to quit. That's how ordinary people become a part of the Gibor, the Giborim, the mighty ones. Perseverance, endurance. Verse 13. Then three of the 30 chief men went down at harvest time and came to David at the cave of Adullam. That's where it all came from. And the troop of Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David said with longing, oh, that someone would give me a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. Oh, I would love that stuff, you know. I wish I'd had a taste of it. So the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink it, but poured it out to the Lord. And he said, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is this not the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their lives? Therefore he would not drink it. These things were done by the three mighty men. So they bring him this cup of water. Adullam is to the left of Jerusalem. It's kind of down the hill a little bit, southwest. So this is where David had been hanging out in his running. The Philistines are in the valley of Rephaim, which comes off of Jerusalem, and there's Bethlehem. And so these fellows get through the camp, get a cup of water, and take it back to David. Just because they hear their buddy saying, "Oh man, I wish I had a drink from that well in Bethlehem. You know, I just love the taste of the Bethlehem water. You know, I don't know if it had little labels on the cups. You know, it said Bethlehem water. I don't know, but these guys hear this and they think, "Well, gee, we love David. You know what, guys? Let's surprise him. Let's go do it." And they went and did it. I'm going to call this principle, this is a Gail Irwin principle, others. One of the qualities of mighty men is that they are centered around others, not themselves. These men, all they care about is doing the right thing and helping and just making a smile on David's face. That's what they want to do. And David, in return, is thinking about them. And he's not about to accept this gift, not after what you just did. It's all about this others thing, about thinking more of others than ourselves. Greatness is not determined by how many people serve you. Greatness is determined by how many people you serve. That's what the Gibor are all about. It's all about others. Jesus said in Mark 10, he said, Jesus called his disciples and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." There's another quality about these men, the Giborim, the mighty men. They were centered around other people. That's what they were for. Verse 18, we'll read about some more guys. Now Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, it's one of David's nephews. He was chief of another three. He lifted his spear against 300 men, killed them, and won a name among these three. Was he not the most honored of three? Therefore, he became their captain. However, he did not attain to the first three. So they've got these, like, you know, levels, you know. They got little stripes on their sleeve or something like this. I don't know. But there's the first three, which we've read about. Now there's another level. And Benaiah was the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man from Kabzeel, who had done many deeds. He had killed two lion-like heroes of Moab. He also had gone down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit on a snowy day. And he killed an Egyptian, a spectacular man. The Egyptian had a spear in his hand. So he went down to him with a staff, wrestled the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. These things Benaiah the son of Jehoiada did and won a name among the three mighty men. He was more honored than the 30, which is another little qualification. So he's above the 30, but he did not attain to the first three, and David appointed him over his guard. He's going to be over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. We talked about them. They're the Philistine secret service. And he will also become head of the army under Solomon, but that's another story. He killed two lion-like men. Gibor, mighty men, are willing to face the giants. Benaiah had this reputation for facing big guys, fierce guys. And you don't hear about him making excuses. You don't hear about him saying, "Yeah, but this like Egyptian guy's like pretty, he's spectacular. You know, he probably just won the WWF something or whatever, you know." and the lion-like men of Moab. And he doesn't make excuses. I think I mentioned this last week. And then I went and made an excuse. gang, that's another one of the tricks of being a mighty man, is you don't make excuses, you just do it. No excuses. We have all our reasons why we can't face the giant, the challenge, the thing we struggle with. But gang, at some point you have to stop making excuses. The secret of facing giants is not to let your fear stop you from doing what is right. Doesn't mean you're not afraid. That's what courage is. Courage is not absence of fear. Courage is being afraid and you do it anyway. I wonder how much more we could accomplish if we didn't let our excuses or our fears stop us from doing what's in front of us. You know, we say, oh, I've tried this before, but I failed. I can't do it. I don't think I can do this. I know I've shown this a bunch of times, but I'm going to show it again.
So, Coach, how strong is Westview this year?
A lot stronger than we are.
You already written Friday night down as a loss, Brock?
Well, not if I know we could beat them.
Come here, Brock. You too, Jeremy.
What, am I in trouble now?
Not yet. I want to see you do the death crawl again, except I want to see your absolute best.
What, you want me to go to the 30?
I think you can go to the 50.
50? I can go to the 50 if nobody's on my back.
I think you can do it with Jeremy on your back. But even if you can, I want you to promise me you're going to do your best.
All right.
Your best.
Okay.
You going to give me your best?
I'm going to give you my best.
All right, one more thing. I want you to do it blindfolded.
Why?
Because I want you giving up at a certain point when you could go further. Get down. Jeremy, get on his back. I get a good tight hold, Jeremy. All right. Let's go, bro. Give me knees off the ground. Just your hands and feet. There you go. A little bit left. A little bit left. There you go. Show me good effort. That way, Brock. You keep coming. There you go. It's a good start. A little bit left. A little bit left. There you go, Brock. Good strength. That's it, Brock. That's it.
Am I at the 20 yet?
Forget the 20. You give me your best. You keep going. That's it. No, don't stop, Brock. You got more in you than that.
I ain't done. Just resting a second.
You got to keep moving. Let's keep moving. Let's go. Don't quit till you got nothing left. There you go. Keep moving. Keep moving. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. You keep driving. Keep your knees off the ground. Keep driving it. Your very best. Your very best. Your very best. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. That's it. That's it. Keep going. Don't quit on me. Keep going. Keep driving it. Keep your knees off the ground. That's it. Your very best. Don't quit on me. Your very best. Keep driving. Keep driving. There you go. There you go. That's it. You keep driving. Keep your knees off the ground. Keep driving it. Don't quit till you got nothing left. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. That's it. That's it. Keep going. I want everything you got. Come on. Keep going.
It hurts.
Don't quit on me. Your very best. Keep driving. Keep driving. There you go. There you go.
He's heavy.
I know he's heavy.
I'm bad out of strength.
Then you negotiate with your body to find more strength, but don't you give up on me, Brock. You keep going, you hear me? You keep going. You're doing good. You keep going. Do not quit on me. You keep going.
It hurts.
I know it hurts. You keep going. You keep going. It's all hard from here. 30 more steps. You keep going, Brock. Come on. Keep going.
Burn.
And let it burn.
It hurts. I'm burning.
It's all hard. You keep going, Brock. Come on. Come on. Keep going. You promised me your best. Your best. Don't stop. Keep going.
Too hard.
It's not too hard. You keep going. Come on, Brock. Give me more. Give me more. Keep going. 20 more steps. 20 more. Keep going, Brock. Give me your best. Don't quit. No. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Don't quit.
Don't quit! Don't quit! Brock Kelly, you don't quit! Keep going! Keep going! Go, Brock Kelly! You don't quit on me! No, you keep going! You keep going! Go, Brock! 10 more steps! 10 more! 10 more! 10 more! Keep going! Don't quit! Give me your heart! You can! You can! 5 more! 5 more! Come on, Brock! Come on! Don't quit! Don't quit! Come on, Brock! 2 more! 1 more!
I've got it, 50. I'll have any more.
Look up, Brock. You're in the end zone. Brock, you are the most influential player on this team. If you walk around defeated, so will they. Don't tell me you can't give me more than what I've been seeing. You just carried a 140-pound man across this whole field in your arms. Brock, I need you. God's gifted you with the ability of leadership. Don't waste it.
Coach?
Can I count on you?
Yes.
Coach?
What is it, Jeremy?
I weigh 160.
Sometimes fear is good. Sometimes fear is our friend because it keeps us away from things that where we shouldn't be. But sometimes fear keeps us from doing what's right. Sometimes, like Brock, we're afraid we can't do any better. He thought maybe he could go 30 yards, maybe 50 without anybody on his back, and then he goes 100. Why? Because he couldn't see it. He just didn't think he could do it. I was talking with a friend yesterday. We need to learn to walk by faith and not by sight. 2 Corinthians 5:7. See, too often we're making choices, we make decisions based on what we see on our senses, on sight, when we need to learn to walk by faith, by trusting Him. And sometimes that's like the blindfold, right? It's kind of like, you know, the old Obi-Wan Kenobi to Luke, you know, close your eyes, Luke, use the Force. Well, it's not a bad picture. It's not that you've got to go through life with your eyes closed. But see, sometimes our senses or our way of looking at things isn't quite, we don't give God the credit that we should of what He can do in our lives, of what we can even do if we'll just let Him. The Gibor, the mighty men, brave men, strong men, mighty men. I love these guys. I hope I can kind of, you know, in heaven, I hope we can kind of like watch in the bleacher seats as these guys arm wrestle or something. You know, I don't know. I just, I love it. I can hardly wait to meet these guys. Verse 24. Asahel, the brother of Joab, was one of the 30. Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem. He's going to go on and list another bunch of stuff. We're going to get into, now we've been to two lists of three. Now we're going to get into a list of 30. So this is the next level down of mighty men. Shammah the Herodite, Elikah the Herodite, and I'm not going to read all these names just for the sake of time. Verse 29, Ittai the son of Ribai from Gibeah, the sons of Benjamin. I thought that was interesting. One of his mighty men hails from Saul's own hometown, Gibeah. And he's a Benjamite, so it's not like all the Benjamites were against David. Let's skip down to verse 33, Shammah the Hararite, Ahiham the son of Sharar the Hararite, Alephalet the son of Ahasbai, the son of the Maacathite, verse 34, Eliam the son of Ahithophel the Gilonite. Eliam the son of Ahithophel. Eliam was the son of David's counselor, David's friend. This is the Ahithophel, because he's from the town of Gilo. Remember, that's where he went to die, and they hung himself. He put his affairs in order after rebellion was crushed, because Ahithophel was David's friend who betrayed him and went after Absalom and tried to follow Absalom. Well, Eliam was Ahithophel's son. Well, that's not all of the story. We believe that this Eliam had a famous daughter as well, because 2 Samuel 11:3 says David sent and inquired about that woman, the one he saw on the rooftop, and someone said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" So again, this is how that connection is made, where we believe that Bathsheba was the granddaughter of Ahithophel. Again, this could have been part of the motive somehow of Ahithophel turning against David. All we can think of is maybe he was embarrassed that his daughter was maybe humiliated, in the sense that she was now going to be known as the adulteress because of David. So this is the connection, is this verse plus 2 Samuel 11. Hezri the Carmelite, verse 35, Paarai the Arbite, a guy from Zobah, a guy from Gad. If you notice, if you were to plot these things, these guys are from all over. They're from all over the map, all over Israel. They've got guys in the north, they've got guys in the south. Verse 39, the last mention is Uriah the Hittite. 37 of all. Yes, that's that guy. His wife Bathsheba, Uriah the Hittite. David isn't the only one who had been betrayed, because David did some of his own betraying. One of his own buddies, his inner group, he messed with his wife. This wasn't a stranger. This wasn't the new girl in town. Didn't know who they were. He knew who they were. He knew better. He knew the family. And you know what's really fascinating? This is all included in the scripture. It's very clear as a bell, right out in front of everybody. Because this is the reality. This is God works with real people, messy people, not perfect people. Verse 1 of chapter 24. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them to say, "Go number Israel and Judah." Now it says the anger of the Lord. Now the parallel passage that you're going to see the same story is in Chronicles. And Chronicles sometimes gives us little commentaries of what's going on in Samuel. In 1 Chronicles 21 it says, "Now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel." We're not told how this all happened, just that it did. That somehow God's anger is stirred up and God allows Satan to put some influence into David. It says God is angry at David, angry at Israel. Some have suggested that the anger may have come from the rebellions, like Absalom, how the whole nation turned against David and followed after Absalom. And then, quick as a bunny, after they crushed that rebellion, then there was that Sheba guy, and they all, quick as a bunny, decided to follow after this guy. So That's an interesting theory, that why God might have been upset with Israel and then started this ball rolling. That's a possibility. That's just conjecture. And David moves against them and says, "Go number Israel and Judah." Now, this numbering of Israel, this isn't about taking a census for the purpose of knowing your population's demographics. This is, in these days, this is, they're starting a draft. Does anybody remember the draft? I remember I registered for the draft, and then like 3 months later, they canceled the draft. Whew. Boy, did I luck out. But that's what this numbering is all about. You see this in the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers is about the numbering of Israel. Numbering of itself is not wrong. That's not going to be the problem. It's not counting people that's wrong, not raising an army that's wrong. Because in the book of Numbers, God tells him to do it at the beginning of the book, and then he wants to do it again at the end of the book to kind of organize the army and put everything in their place. I think, and this is simply conjecture, because you can only kind of draw some conclusions. I think this is about pride. Why in the world does David need to raise an army? At this point, there is no enemy on the horizon. What does he need a bigger, badder army for? Maybe he wants to puff out his chest and brag about the size of his army. Could be that after the rebellions, not that he thinks he has to raise a big army for the next rebellion, but maybe if he just puts the whole nation into his giant army, maybe then they'll all stay in line. Could be something like this. Joab, in a few verses, is going to hint that it seems like David is not relying on the Lord, but wanting to rely on his army. And David ought to know better, because David himself wrote, "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God." I think that was in one of the songs we did tonight, too, about his name. David knows better. He should be knowing to trust in the Lord, but he's just got this thing in him. He just wants to have a big, awesome army. God doesn't want us doing things out of pride. 1 Peter 5, "Yes, all of you be submissive to one another, be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." That's my theory. That's my working theory about what is wrong with the numbering. The numbering itself isn't wrong, but something about it is. Other suggestions in, I think it's Exodus. There's a command that if you ever number the people, you're supposed to take a half a shekel as a ransom for them. And the old historian Josephus says that David didn't take the ransom. Now, what that's all about, I don't know. That's another theory. I'm hanging on pride right now. So, verse 2. "So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army, who was with him, 'Now go throughout all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and count the people that I may know the number of the people.'" Now, Dan to Beersheba, Dan is the farthest, northernmost city of the nation, all the way up in the north above the Sea of Galilee, and Beersheba is the most southern point in the nation. So anytime you see this from Dan to Beersheba, as you're saying, from the top to the bottom, from the north to the south, number everybody, get everybody in the army. Verse 3. "And Joab said to the king, 'Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times more than there are, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it.'" But why does my lord the king desire this thing? So you kind of get the feeling that Joab thinks there's kind of something hinky about this thing. It is like, it's, they don't know David. And it's funny because Joab is kind of a jerk most of the time. So it's kind of, if even the jerk recognizes that there's a problem here, there's got to be something up with this, right? You know, even the jerk knows that there's something wrong. Verse 4, "Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the army." He just kept pushing him until he did it. "Therefore, Joab and the captains of the army went out from the presence of the king to count the people. They crossed over the Jordan, camped in Aroer." This is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, on the right side of the town, which is the midst of the ravine of Gad and toward Jazer. And they came to Gilead, which up towards the north, to the land of Tatim Hodshi. They came to Dan Ya'an and around to Sidon. They came to the stronghold of Tyre, all the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites. They went out to South Judah as far as Beersheba. So when they had gone through all the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. Joab gave the sum of the number of the people of the king to the king. And there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men. So they make a big circle. They go off to the right. They go all the way up to the north. They make a big circle, come all the way back around, and they come up with this number. Verse 10. "And David's heart condemned him after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now I pray, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. His heart condemned him. His heart is smitten. He's convicted. He knows that he did the wrong thing. It took him 10 months, but his heart convicted him, and he realizes it. It's not a bad idea, gang, every once in a while to pay attention to those heart warnings. You know, when you just got this feeling like I'm doing the wrong thing, sometimes you need to pay attention to that. Sometimes the heart's deceitful, wicked, and we can fool ourselves, yes. But gang, sometimes God's trying to get your attention. Romans 14 is a great principle. It says, do you have faith? Have it before yourself, before God. Happy is the man who does not condemn himself in what he approves, but he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith, for whatever is not from faith is sin. Now, the issue in Romans 14 is about should we eat meat or not. And he kind of says it's kind of a yes, no, it's a gray area. It's like, you know, you don't. And basically, if you don't feel good about it, don't do it. If your heart condemns you, don't do it. I'm trying to learn this. I'm not always good at it. But sometimes I got this iffy thing going on in my heart, you know, about something, a decision that I'm making. And I'm kind of thinking, and I feel the pressure to make a decision, but I don't feel good about it. I'm trying to learn to wait, to feel confident about it. Sometimes you just got to go out and do it. I don't know. But I see that at work here. 10 months later is like, okay, yeah, my heart was kind of convicting me of this. Pay attention to the heart warnings. Verse 11. Now when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, his prophet, saying, go and tell David, thus says the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose one of them for yourself, that I may do it to you. Something has to be taken care of. Something has to be done about this sin. Somebody's got to pay for it. This is still the Old Testament. Jesus hasn't died for his sins. Some kind of payment is required. So Gad came to David and told him, and he said to him, shall 7 years of famine come to you or in your land, or shall you flee 3 months before your enemies while they pursue you, or shall there be 3 days plague in your land? Now consider and see what answer I should take back to him who sent me. I think that's kind of funny. You know, I got to go back to God and tell him. So what? Which one is it? It's fascinating. And David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Please let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. David knows quite well what it is to fall into the hand of man. He's lived through it with Saul. He's seen it with his son. He's seen it with all kinds of stuff. He knows how cruel men can be. Verse 15, so the Lord sent a plague upon Israel from the morning to the appointed time, from Dan to Beersheba, from the north to the south. 70,000 men of the people died. If the sin was involving the pride in the number, it is fascinating that the penalty affects the number. You want to be such a hot shot because you got so much? Well, let's take some of that away. I don't know. That's just a theory. That's a way of looking at it. There are consequences to sin. Like,
the trunk monkey theft retrieval system. Because sometimes getting your car back is simply not enough. Another revolutionary idea. You'll only find at Suburban Auto Group. Pending approval from the Department of Agriculture.
Now, even nowadays in the New Covenant, we may confess our sin. God can forgive us. He will. We did this on Sunday. If we confess our sins, he will forgive us. He's faithful. He's just to forgive us. That doesn't mean that you're not going to still have consequences, earthly consequences to your sin. You may still have to face the trunk monkey. I mean, you try to steal a car, you know, you're gonna get in trouble, right? You can confess before God. God can forgive you. You may be right before God, but you may have a problem with the trunk monkey. Sometimes Satan whispers in our ear as the pressure is building, the temptations are coming, and they get louder, and they get louder, and they get louder, and the pressure is building up to do this evil thing. And Satan whispers in your ear, just do it so the pressure gets off. Remember, friends, there are consequences to our sin. It's better to learn to take the pressure. Oh, it's way better than to face that drunk monkey. Way better. There are consequences to sin. This is a tough thing that hits the nation. The angel stretched out his hand over Jerusalem to destroy it. The Lord relented from the destruction and said to the angel who was destroying the people, it's enough. Now restrain your hand. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Arauna, the Jebusite. Threshing floor, this is on the top of the hill, is where this is taking place. The angel of the Lord, this is Jesus Christ, we believe. The words are a very specific usage in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew. It identifies a specific individual. And you track this whole thing, you find out this person is called God. This person is worshipped. We believe this is Jesus Christ before he takes on human flesh. He always was. He's always existed. And so you would think he would show up in the Old Testament. Well, he does. We think it's... And the word angel in the Old Testament, just like the New Testament, it means a messenger. It doesn't mean necessarily the created race of beings that we call angels, that we limit to what we call angels. It's a messenger of the Lord. John the Baptist in the New Testament is called a messenger. So it's more of a generic term than we kind of tend to use it for. Verse 17, then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, surely I have sinned. I have done wickedly, but these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray, be against me and against my father's house. I like this. This is a great marks of a great leader, gang. He accepts responsibility. This is my fault. I'm the one that's done this. The altar, verse 18, and Gad came that day to David and said to him, go up, erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Arauna, the Jebusite. So David, according to the word of Gad, went up as the Lord commanded. And Arauna looked and saw the king and his servants coming toward him. So Arauna went out and bowed before the king with his face to the ground. You can trace in the parallel passages that they actually see the angel. Arauna and his sons see him, and they're terrified. In chapter 21, it says that David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between earth and heaven. This isn't just some cloud or something. They see the guy. And Arauna said, why has my lord, the king, come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you, to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be withdrawn from the people. And Arauna said to David, let my lord the king take and offer whatever seems good to him. Look, here are oxen for burnt sacrifice and threshing implements, and the yokes for the oxen for wood. All these, O king, Arauna has given to the king. And Arauna said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. And the king said to Arauna, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price. Nor will I offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God with that which costs me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 pieces of 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So the Lord heeded the prayers for the land, and the plague was withdrawn from Israel. Few last points. Beautiful, beautiful verse here in verse 24. I will not offer that which costs me nothing. This is what sacrifice is all about. Sacrifice is what costs you something. Now, in a sense, we no longer practice sacrifice in one sense because Jesus paid for our sins as that kind of a sacrifice. But gang, there is still sacrifice throughout the New Testament that we need to pay attention to. Romans 12:1 says to offer our bodies as living sacrifices. So you offer him, you don't offer him what costs you nothing. Sometimes being the living sacrifice means that I learn. I have to say no to myself. I have to say no to this thing that I crave, that I want, that I think I ought to have the right to do, but I don't. And it becomes my living sacrifice. It is costly. Philippians 2:17, Paul talks about being poured out as a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of your faith. And there, the sacrifice is all what ministry is about. Sometimes serving others is costly to us. It costs us something. Sometimes it's emotional heartache. Sometimes, it costs a few dollars. Sometimes it happens. You know, that's what it's all about. That's what ministry is all about. It costs me my time. Hebrews 13:15 talks about the sacrifice of praise. And to be honest, sometimes we don't feel like praising Him. And we come into church and I'm cranky or I'm upset or I'm mad or I'm, you know, I don't like the person that I argued with in the car all the way over here. Or that boss at work or that, you know, the thing I'm struggling with. And here we are and Dave's leading us in worship and we're talking about praising God and saying, I love you, God. And so I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to keep my hands right under by my side, you know. Sometimes praise is costly. And I learned to do it. Anyway, I gotta give up the junk in my heart and offer Him sacrifice of praise. And it says, verse 25, God heeded their prayers. The parallel passage tells us that He answered with fire from heaven. They lay out the thing. They didn't even struck the match yet. And God answers by fire from heaven. That's only happened three times in the Old Testament, in the Bible. It happens with Moses in the tabernacle. It happens here. And the two other times when Solomon sets up worship in the temple. And it will happen again with Elijah and the prophets of Baal. But those are the only times. Those are unique times. Those are incredible times. Those are amazing times. This is a signpost. Something significant has happened here. And what you see is David's sin being turned into something good. Just like his sin with Bathsheba screwed up a lot of people's lives, and yet they had the kid named Solomon. Go figure. Doesn't seem right. Here, his sin, whether it's pride or whatever it is, and something happens. Arana's threshing floor is a special place. Chronicles says that when David sees this, now if you're not careful and you're just like you end at chapter 21 and you close your Bible and say, thus endeth my reading for the day, and you forget to read the next verse in the next chapter, you think, and that endeth the end of the story. And the next day you pick it up in chapter 22 and you hear, and David said, this is the house of the Lord. And you're like, huh? What? No. Because it's at this moment, the fire comes down, that David realizes, the light bulb goes on in his head. Oh my goodness, oh my goodness, this is it. I've wanted to build God a house. This is the place. We're told, 2 Chronicles 3, when Solomon builds the house, he builds it at that spot, at that threshing floor. This is that moment. This is that moment when things all come together in David's head and he realizes that this whole event that we're reading, it was all to get David there. It wasn't to do this, but this is what God does with it. He turns it around and this is where the temple is built. I find it interesting to think about the fact that Jesus is kind of there, right? Because he's the angel of the Lord and all that kind of stuff. So Jesus is there, and I find it very fascinating that the place that Jesus dies, my favorite theory is that the location of the crucifixion is to the north of the temple, outside of the city walls. But that's still considered Mount Moriah. This is the place. This is the place where Jesus will pay for us. Cool stuff happens here. What an awesome, amazing story. Sorry I've had to rush us through this, but oh my gosh. This is one of those huge events. in the Bible. Let's stand and pray. Lord, we talked about a lot of things, and we are trusting that you will help us to chew on and think through and work on the things that you were wanting to impress on our hearts from your word. Use these mighty men and women. Help us to be counted in the number. Help us learn sacrifice. Thank you. In Jesus' name. Amen. All right. God bless you. Mm-hmm.